You know I'm right. Nick Durst here with Joe Calabrese. And Joe, very excited for our guest today. Well-known baseball writer, and for our New York audience, they see her quite a bit on local TV as well. So why don't you tell everybody who we have with us today?
Yeah, she's currently a senior national writer for The Athletic. Regularly can be seen on MLB Network. And as you alluded to, yes, right here on SNY here in New York. She's previously covered the Orioles and the Nationals beat for MLB.com. So we're very happy to have her. And she's a Michigan State grad. So as you know, Nick, I always have to
throw in
my Michigan stuff. Britt Giroli. Britt, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. And are you a Michigan guy, I take it?
We're a state person over here. I dated a girl long distance for a couple of years, and she's from Grand Rapids, so her family, they're all diehard Michigan State fans.
All right, good, yeah. Good. That was it. That was important to get out of the way right there.
That's right.
It's all about the Spartans here on this podcast. Every time we have Michigan people on, Joe.
I got to flash up the knowledge, you know?
Got it.
So Britt, when you were growing up, what made you say, hey, maybe I could pursue a career in sports, and what made you want to go down that path?
Yeah, so I was always an athlete. I always liked watching sports. At Michigan State, I was on the swim team. And I realized pretty quickly that, as most people do, that your sports career is going to be over after that, right? Whether it's little league or high school or college, very few people go on to the pros. And, you know, I couldn't be a pro swimmer. That wasn't going to pay the bills. And the next best thing in my mind was getting paid to watch sports. So I've always really liked reading and writing. And just sort of took to journalism. I got an internship with MLB.com right out of Michigan State, and really just haven't looked back from there.
So you were on the varsity swim team as well, and all academic Big Ten. So what else did you do when you were at Michigan State?
You know, the normal college things, party,
regret eating
late night pizza. You know, no, I swam, and I did not do the school newspaper, which I know a lot of people in journalism do. And I think it's great. I just simply didn't have time for it playing a sport. I worked every summer as well, put myself through college with that money a lot. I remember one summer I would work at a bar until like 2 or 3 in the morning and then wake up at 6 for a swim practice. So pretty busy with training and all of that stuff. And I tried to have as many internships as I could. As I said, I couldn't do the school newspaper, but I could intern. I could find like little couple month things to do. I interned with Fox Sports Detroit. I did some stuff for the newspaper there, the Lansing State Journal. So I was able to kind of build a little bit of a base, which is really important in journalism, because nobody cares about your GPA. They want to know, what have you done? And it's just such a different field than, say, and my husband's an engineer, and people just want to know his GPA. And then, you know, he graduated and got a job. And in journalism, you're behind the eight ball if you graduate and you look for internships. You need to already have some internships under your belt, I think. Otherwise, you're just starting far behind everybody else.
And you were a Mary Gardner Scholar. Is that right?
Yes, I am. Yes. Mm-hmm.
One of the top students in your class.
A great award, a great journalism program at Michigan State. Lorianne Dickerson runs that program, and her husband Dan Dickerson is the voice of the Tigers, and so they have a lot of connections in the sports journalism world. A lot of great sports journalists have come out of Michigan State. Jamel Hill, Michigan State grad, she actually wrote me a recommendation letter in college. Charles Robinson at Yahoo. Bill Plunkett, who works out in LA. I mean, the list kind of goes on. Jordan Bastian works from MLB.com, Kelly Thesier, LPGA. They're kind of everywhere. So that's another great networking tool I tell people as well, is people want to help like students that went to their school. There's that bond. You feel like, you know, you're in the trenches together, even though you really weren't. So it can be another great way to kind of get your foot in the door.
Another Michigan State grad who we've had on the podcast here is Ryan Field. And as you know, Ryan Field is now the lead sports anchor for ABC7 here. So just wanted to throw that out there as well. So we'll get back to you. You've already mentioned a couple of your internships, a couple of your early roles right here. So You were an associate reporter for the Rays for a brief period of time, and you also did editorial production stuff for the minor league website. Now, I do digital content. I work at NHL.com. Nick formerly worked for Bleacher Report, but I also do digital content, and I did it for a brief period of time for MLB.com, right? So kind of know the systems that they have over there. So you were an editorial producer for a brief period of time. How did those opportunities come about?
So as I said, the internship with MLB.com came when I graduated Michigan State. Once you kind of get your foot in the door, MILB, Minor League Baseball, was in that same building. If you recall, if you worked there, you know, it was like all in Chelsea Market before they moved. So that was really easy to just pick up some work there. And as I said, like one internship always kind of leads to the other. In my case with MLB, I took an internship and then ended up turning that into a job. I ended up covering the Orioles 2010. And so I don't really have too much ping ponging back and forth. I interned, I spent a year at home in 2009, freelancing for MLB.com. And then I got hired and I spent the next decade with Major League Baseball. So I got really fortunate in that regard. The Rays were good that year in 2008. If you remember, it was like the year they came out of nowhere. They went to the World Series. It was super exciting. And I think that helped because the playoffs were there. They were hosting all these big games. And I treated every playoff game like a job interview. I mean, I was shaking hands, introducing myself, just trying to get my name out there. And if they were terrible, if they were a 50-60 win team, I wouldn't have met those people. I wouldn't have made those connections. MLB wouldn't have noticed, hey, you know, this young woman we have down in Tampa is doing a pretty good job interning. You know, nobody would have read those stories. So I always say that my fate was directly tied to the Tampa Bay Rays getting good. And so I always have kind of a special affinity for that team as a result.
Absolutely. So you mentioned it, you really make your name with the Orioles, covering them on a daily basis. What was the process like for you, you know, going to that first spring training, and how did you really integrate with the team and build up your sources and whatnot and relationships?
Yeah, so that was obviously terrifying. I was 21 years old, covering a Major League Baseball team. And, you know, it's one thing to be an intern and have somebody above you and have someone tell you what to do. And I was only there for the home games with the Rays. It's another thing to be responsible for a team. And like you said, sources and news breaking. And I really didn't learn how to properly build sources until I came to The Athletic. It wasn't emphasized at MLB. It was more of a, let's focus on the positive stuff. Let's confirm if somebody else has news. So, you know, it wasn't until later in my career that I really feel like I became more of an actual reporter. I felt like at MLB and on the Orioles beat, I was more of a writer first. It was more about features and getting to know prospects. And, you know, they wanted to celebrate baseball, and they still do. They wanted to celebrate the positives of baseball. And that was a perfect job for me, because at 21 years old, I would have gotten crushed if I was working for a newspaper and like had to develop sources and call agents and do all of these things. So I always look at it as kind of glass half full. If I hadn't have spent the time there, I wouldn't have made the player connections and built kind of the database of phone numbers and relationships that I had. But also I did feel like when I left there, I was really ill-equipped to be an actual reporter somewhere else, because there wasn't a whole lot of emphasis on sources and breaking news. And maybe I should have done a better job with that, but because we didn't have to, I never really learned to do that until really 3 years ago at The Athletic.
Well, I think the big pro out of your relationship building there is that this offseason, everybody was contacting you to give some information on Buck Showalter because of your time with him. So what was it like just being there in the clubhouse with him, and how does that differentiate from other maybe more new school managers you've been around?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know why people think he's old school. It's because he's old.
I mean, I would consider old school like has managerial experience, and then new school is like first time manager.
I guess he will now. With this season, he will have managed in four different decades, right?
Yeah, so he was
new. So a veteran versus a rookie manager, I'll say.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So he, when he was the Yankees manager, he was new school, but now he's old school. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think about him like that at all, which is why it's fascinating to me. I think people throw that out there. I don't really consider him an old school manager. I consider him someone who knows a lot about baseball, and I don't think it matters how old you are. If you managed before, if you know baseball, you're going to be good at the job. If you don't, if you can manage people, if you don't, you're not going to do well. So, you know, I think Mets are going to love him and love hearing his stories. I have heard all these stories for 10 years. So every time I hear something from him, I almost know what he's going to say before he says it. You know, I am like, oh, there he goes with the not getting out of this alive quote. Oh, there he goes with telling Lindor the fans are waiting to embrace you. It's almost like I'm checking cards off my bingo sheet at this point in time, because, you know, you're around someone day in, day out for the better part of a decade, and you know them very well. And so I'm excited for him. I'm excited for Mets fans to kind of see what he's able to do there.
Yeah, Nick is the Mets fan of the two of us. I'm the Yankees fan here. And it's funny because you were in Tampa when the Rays were good, right? You went to Baltimore and they had their best seasons here in the last 20 years or so when you were there covering the team as well. So it seems like there's something to wherever you are. A team being good, and the last thing I need to hear is him telling me how the Mets are going to win 95 games going into the season, so. 100 games, and you know, they're going to go to the World Series.
I got one more for you. I was in New York in 2009 because I live in Connecticut.
And my parents, that's right. Yeah,
my parents are from Connecticut, so I used to drive from our house in Connecticut to. They would have me do Mets and Yankees, but the Mets kind of fell off that year, and the Yankees, obviously, that was last year they won the World Series, and I was. You know, cheap labor. So MLB just kept saying, yeah, if you want to show up, you can come help. And I'd leave my house at like 1 p.m, you know, get up to the stadium, and then they'd play the game at 8 p.m. the playoff games, right? You're getting out of there like 2 in the morning. I'd get home at like 4, and then I'd sleep, wake up, eat breakfast, and go back to the stadium. And it was awesome. it was awesome. Not sustainable at all, but I had just graduated, you know, college, had that internship, and was kind of waiting for something from MLB. And what a great year that was. I mean, that was probably the last fun Yankees team I've been around. I always say like the Yankees aren't as fun as they used to be. They had Nick Swisher that year. Who's just always like a 10 out of 10. They had AJ Burnett, and they were passing around his son's WWE belt. Like they had like player of the game in there. So after going from the Rays to the Yankees, and then in 10, when I got the Orioles job and they were terrible, I was like, oh my God, everyone's so angry all the time. Like I'd gotten so spoiled early on. But as you mentioned, I did also see that. And also I was with the Nationals in 2019. Right. When they went to the World Series. I covered the Nationals for 2 years before I got promoted to just like national MLB stuff. So I've been really fortunate to see a lot of winning teams. And it's been a lot of fun. Those teams are way more fun to cover. And I was at the Yankees camp, I don't know, like a week and a half ago. And I was like, this team still doesn't really have that energy. Maybe Donaldson brings it. Maybe winning helps bring that out in these guys, but they just don't seem to have like that same charisma. And I think that's part of the reason they got a guy like Donaldson to kind of maybe shake it up a little bit in there. I don't know. It's very interesting to see the teams that win and the teams that don't, just the differences in how they operate.
Yeah. The winning team always seems to have some sort of character that maybe isn't the best player, but certainly the fan and clubhouse favorite that can carry them through. Now, you mentioned that routine where you were going in 2009. What is your routine now? I guess we'll say like pre-COVID, before the Zoom stuff, where you would be going to a game. What time would you get there? You know, who are you speaking with first? And most importantly, we want to know, what are you eating pre-game? Are you eating on snack during the game? What are you having? What's that routine like?
Yeah. So my routine is totally different now because I'm not on a beat. So lots of times I won't go to the stadium because I can just call guys. I've built up a network where I can call GMs, I can call agents, I can call people. I would say where I live now is midway between Baltimore and DC. So I'll always look at who those teams are playing, kind of what the matchup is. And if I want to go, I try to at least make it to the stadium once a week or so. Sometimes it's more, sometimes, you know, the Orioles aren't really playing anyone, the Nats are out of town, and I don't end up going. So for me, being a national writer, what people don't know is like, you go for the clubhouse and you often leave. You don't stay for the games. You don't stay for the post game. That stuff doesn't matter anymore when you're a national writer. When I was on the beat, I would have to be there early. I'd have to stay the entire game. I'd have to stay 90 minutes in the clubhouse post game, write my story. And certainly then you bring snacks, right? But now in my role, I don't have the, my schedule is so much better than it used to be. I always joke, I spent my 20s in a Marriott, which I did. You know, I don't have these three city road trips. I kind of pick and choose where I go, who I talk to, and what my schedule is on a daily basis. And for me now, it's perfect. I couldn't have done it without all those years of like schlepping to the stadium and putting in 15-hour days. But my schedule now is very much fluid. It's very much like what I want it to be today, who I want to call, what I want to write about. And I can't say enough about how great that has been.
So you joined The Athletic after being a MLB.com reporter. You mentioned there were some challenges. First of all, how did that opportunity come about for you? And then secondly, was it difficult to switch teams and basically have to maybe somehow hit the reset button when it comes to building relationships?
So no, it wasn't. I kind of had it in my mind in 2015, my dad passed away from lung cancer, and I just kind of felt like, what am I doing here? I had been covering the Orioles since 2010. They were okay in 16. They went to the wild card game and they lost, but then they were just bad. And even beyond the team, I just felt like I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. I was doing the same thing every day, you know, going to the stadium, talking to a player, watching the game, putting my quotes in. It felt like I was doing like a paint by numbers kind of thing. I was like walking through the motions. I was just burnt out. So 2018 was when the Orioles really sank to an all low. And I would remember I would get to the stadium as late as I could. I would leave as early as I could. And I started thinking like, this, what am I doing? This was my dream job. Like, this isn't a job where, you know, you punch in, punch out. This is a job that you have to love because there are nights and weekends and sacrifices. You know, you miss holidays and weddings and birthdays, and all that stuff had kind of started to build up, I think. And I had kind of said to myself, like, I'm not covering this team next year. If I leave the business, I leave the business. So what a lot of people don't realize is I reached out to The Athletic and I said, hey, I heard you guys need an Nats writer. You know, I live in Baltimore. It's about an hour away. And I said, I'll be honest with you. And I told them this when they offered me the job. I don't know how many more years I have left of this in me. I just don't. I had kind of really reached the end of a rope. And they were like, okay, let's see how this goes. And The Athletic kind of really re-energized me and maybe saved my career, I think, because the way they were doing it wasn't like this. We need a notebook and we need a game story and we need a preview. It was like, cover the Nationals, write what you want, do some good stuff, and we'll leave you alone. And that just kind of like picked me up off the mat. And I was able to write the stories I wanted to write and not sit there and try to figure out how to write some like boring mid-May doubleheader game where, you know, the pitcher goes five innings and it's just like, meh. And I didn't have to write about games anymore. I could pick the stories I wanted to. And that really, really saved me. Otherwise I probably wouldn't be in this business anymore.
So we've also had Mark Carrigan from The Athletic, and he was unbelievable as well. And he had a really great wall of hats behind him that, you know, unfortunately you don't have. But I just wanted to ask quickly the differences and what was the transition like from doing the daily grind of covering the Orioles beat and doing team beats as opposed to doing the national stuff. Now, what other kind of details are in there that maybe other people who are reporters out there in the business or people who are looking to make that type of transition in their careers later on, what else is there for them to know?
Yeah, I always say it's really important to have the beat experience. I mean, you do see some people that just get hired to be national writers that have never been beat writers. And I think you're at a disadvantage because you don't have those relationships with players and coaches and you know, other teams. You guys mentioned Buck. I mean, you can't replicate 10 years that I spent with that guy every day, right? You know, some of the relationships I've had with players who played for a long time in Baltimore that are now on other teams, Zach Britton, now with the Yankees. Like, these are things that you can't really replicate. Even covering Max Scherzer in a beat setting for 2 years gives me a significant advantage as a national person going in. You know, I know him, I have a relationship with him. So being on a beat for, you know, 9 years in Baltimore, 2 years in DC, that's 11 years worth of rosters. So I walk into almost any clubhouse and I know someone personally, like I've covered them before, or a coach, or somebody in the front office. And that right there, I think, gives you the leg up. It's really important. So if you don't have that, and I think a lot of people want to skip that step because the beat is a grind, it's exhausting, it's not glamorous. But if you lay that foundation, then I think it makes things a little bit easier. Certainly made the transition for me a lot easier, knowing that, okay, I know almost one person on every team. And there are teams I know better than others. And there are teams where I'm not as plugged in, but I think in terms of having a foundation, that's really important. I also think it's a lot more at homework, a lot more working the phones, because me just going to the stadium and standing in the locker room and doing what all the other reporters are doing isn't serving anybody. You're constantly trying to find different stuff. So it's harder in that regard, and that you're always making kind of phone calls. You're always trying to figure out what you can do that's a little bit different, even when you're at the stadium. And I think people get too caught up in like trying to follow the crowd too much. And the only way to make yourself stand out, especially in a national role, when you're competing against just the best people at the top of our profession, is to do things differently, is to make that extra phone call. Joel Sherman, who works at the New York Post, who has been a terrific friend and mentor to me, always says, like, I might not be the best writer, but I know I'm going to outwork someone. They're going to make 10 calls, I'm going to make 11, right? They're going to go to bed at 10 o'clock, I'm going to stay till 11 in case I get a call. And I think that really resonated with me, knowing that, you know, just because they say, oh, the media availability is Tuesday, doesn't mean you can't go Monday and try to get somebody to talk to you, right? Like, little things like that make a huge difference, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. The grind is important there. And like you said, all those connections invaluable to you for sure. How did you end up doing some TV work? How did the S&Y opportunity come about for you? And was TV ever anything you thought about, or did it kind of just fall into your lap?
Yeah. So the network stuff started when I was on the Orioles beat, and they used to have like a rundown show, and people would kind of come on. So I did that for a while when I was on that beat, and a little bit with the Nats as well. I don't do anything with MLB Network anymore. They don't really align editorially with a lot of the things that the Athletic writes and the things that the Athletic does. And, you know, they have their own separate set of priorities, which is fine. SNY last year reached out to me, and I honestly was a little concerned because I had written the Mickey Callaway story. We had written about the culture of the Mets. And I was like, these people are never going to want me to come on and talk about the Mets. Like, but they've been terrific in terms of, you know, editorial freedom, independence. You know, they don't shy away from, and what I think SNY does better than really any other regional sports network is they don't shy away from bad stuff. They don't pretend their fans are idiots. And I think too many places now try to make their broadcast super homerish and try to always just be like, oh, everything's great, we're losing 9-0, but man, that was a great seventh inning. And I think it's patronizing. I think fans know the difference. They want you to be real. And I think SNY does just really the best job in the industry at being critical when it's needed, at admitting when things aren't great. And that's what's been so awesome about SNY. And that's why I really enjoyed doing stuff for them. I was just on last night, actually. And they really care about getting things right. They don't focus on the bad, but they don't shy away from it either. And I think a lot of RSNs would be better served if they did that. In terms of TV stuff, when I was coming into this business, I wanted to do play-by-play or color or be an analyst. There were just no women doing that. In 2008, Susan Waldman was doing radio, but nobody was getting hired in the minor leagues for that. There was no path of, oh, if you do this, you'll get hired to do this. So I got that internship, like I said, and kind of never looked back. And I do enjoy the TV side of things. I do some radio here in DC as well. I do enjoy that part. That's something I'm looking to kind of, as I grow in my role at the Athletic, continue to expand. Because what I don't see now is I see a lot of women on the sidelines. I see a lot of women that are hosts. We're even seeing women that are play-by-play. But what I don't see now is women that are allowed to give their opinion, women that analyze games, women that have earned the right because they've been in the sport for long enough to do exactly what the men have been doing forever. You know, this is my 15th year in baseball, and I finally feel comfortable giving my opinion, writing columns, putting myself out there because I feel like I have the background to back it up. And I hope that's kind of the next wave of what we see here. It's not just women, you know, kind of being that pretty ornament in the corner so they can say, oh, look, we have females involved. No, I would love to see more women like Ramona Shelburne for ESPN, who covers the NBA, and I think does a terrific job breaking news, analyzing things. I would like to see more women like that in prominent roles in baseball.
Yeah, so I freelanced for CBS Sports for a bit, and I remember when they launched We Need to Talk, right? So I think in a similar vein of what you're talking about, I do think people like you would benefit from more all-female roundtable sports type of shows. And I think that's a terrific idea. So Nick and I, we follow SNY very, very closely. We've had a lot of great people on SNY and a lot of people here in New York on the to do WFAN because like the crossover obviously between the radio station and the network is so significant and great. We've had a lot of great people on with us. So I wanted to ask, would you ever make a full-time transition into TV, or are you very comfortable just kind of consistently been doing what you're doing?
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think I would miss writing if I was told I couldn't write at all. But I also wonder if I did take a full-time, let's say, analyst role or I was just like on a show every day, could I freelance? Could I still do those things? I think what's important, if I ever did make that jump to just TV or did a lot more TV, is that I was a reporter first. And I've talked to people. Ken Rosenthal has been great in terms of mentoring me as well. And people have pointed out that you're a reporter first. Just because you're on TV doesn't mean you're not making phone calls, you're not doing interviews, you're not taking notes. Those are actually the best TV reporters, right? Those are the best analysts. Those are the people bringing you the best stuff. You see Woj in the NBA and Adam Schefter. These people are still reporting. They're not just going on TV, you know, kind of filling the air. And so I think that maybe I would consider a job like that where I was able to still report. Would I ever want to just be a host? No. And this isn't a knock on hosts at all. I think that job is super hard. There's a lot of traffic copping going on. I don't know how they do it, honestly, like talking while someone else is counting down in their ear. Yeah. But for me, I need to have a reporting element. I need to have an element that still connects me to journalism because I think no matter what kind of reporting you do, and I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see like Amazon and YouTube and you know, more of these podcasts become shows, right? I think no matter what you do, you need to adhere to a lot of those journalism rules still in order to stand out because that's the way you break news. That's the way you come up with creative things. That's the way you tell stories about these players and these coaches and these games that nobody else has. And I don't ever want to lose that.
What's the biggest differences for you between writing, doing TV and radio when it comes to potentially talking about the same story on all three?
That's a good question. If you were just going to say biggest difference, I was going to say, man, TV takes forever because you got to put your makeup on, you got to get your hair done. Radio is great because you can just roll out of bed and it's just your voice. Same thing with writing. Nobody cares. You need to make yourself a little more presentable when you're going to the stadium, but you know, they're different in that regard. But I think for TV, it's always the highlights, right? You usually have 30 to 60 seconds and you don't have time to kind of build a narrative like you do in writing. You can kind of set the tone. You can go through descriptions and things like this and really kind of draw the reader in and keep them drawn in. TV, it's like, okay, quick hit. We need the highlights. And very often on TV, it's not just what you say, it's how you say it. It's what graphics go with it, right? It is how you look. It is how you present the information. So I think that's different as well. I often have to slow myself down. I'm a fast talker. That's fine for radio. On TV, they want you to be able to kind of tell that story slowly. You know, you've heard those like pregnant pauses almost, right? To like keep the tension going. So those mediums are all very different, which is kind of why I guess I enjoy them all because it just keeps you sharp. I think anybody who thinks, well, I can just be a writer or I can just go on the radio or I can just do TV is really making themselves expendable. And I've always had this rule of like, make yourself tough to fire. That's really been my like guiding light. Like how do you stay in this business? You make yourself tough to fire. I want them to look at me and say, God, if we get rid of Brittany, we got to find someone who can do a podcast. We got to find someone who can do the writing. We got to find someone who can, you know, I've been learning Spanish for the last 2 years. So you just want them to be like, oh, it's not worth it. We can't get rid of her. We'd have to hire two people. So that's kind of always been my guiding light is how do you diversify yourself so much that you make yourself impossible to fire?
Yeah, the more versatile you can be, just like in baseball, play many positions and you got a better chance of staying on the team. So that's fantastic advice. What would you say for you in your career is your you know I'm right moment? So what I mean by that is a time where you wanted to pursue something or do something, you ask somebody for advice, they say, I don't know, Britt, I don't think you should do that. And you said, or you just acted and you were like, I'm going to do it anyway. And ultimately you will see why it is that I'm right.
Ooh, I've had a couple of those. So when I graduated from Michigan State, I had an offer at two small newspapers, full-time job offers, and I had the MLB.com internship. Now, the MLB.com internship was going to pay me $500 a week, no healthcare. You know, it was going to end when the race season ended. And so many people said to me, take the newspaper job, like, take the full-time job, take the benefits, take the salary, you know, working for $500 a week for a few months until the Rays are done. Like, what's that going to do? So obviously I didn't listen there. I just thought, you know, getting the ability to have worst case scenario, having clips of a big league team, being around a big league team, I thought was going to parlay itself into something eventually. And obviously it did. I never looked back. I was very fortunate, to kind of keep that going. And then when I left MLB, people don't talk about this, but the league jobs are incredibly secure, cushy jobs. I had a pension. I had free healthcare. I had a job that, let's be honest, I was probably never going to get fired at. You know, I was covering the Orioles. I'd been covering them for a while. It was easy. I had everyone's phone number. I could do that job in my sleep. And I looked around and I'm like, do I want to do this for the next 30 years, you know, 30 plus years? And I didn't. And so many people, when I said, I'm going to the Athletic, which in 2018 was a startup. It wasn't nearly as big as it is as we sit here now. It wasn't owned by the Times, right? So many people were like, don't you have a pension? Don't you have, like, don't you have really good benefits there? You know? And I was at the point where if the Athletic went under, I was going to leave the industry and I was going to be okay with it. And I think in order to make those big risks, you have to be okay with failure. You have to be okay with kind of falling flat on your face and saying, if this doesn't work, at least I tried it, because that was going to be better for me than the regret of never leaving. And so those were kind of the two moments for me that really changed the scope of my career, right? If I had taken a job at a newspaper, I could have been laid off already. I could have been out of this business. I could have been covering something else. If I had stayed at MLB, I'd probably still be covering the Orioles and I would just be utterly miserable. And, you know, as you get older, I think it gets harder to leave places. You know, I'm 6 months pregnant now. And would I have left a job with free healthcare if I had kids, if I had a family? You know, I was single. I was able to take that risk. And I think that's really important as well. But you have to be, I always say, we're in a business of risk. My husband, as I mentioned, is an engineer. His job is very stable. He moves up very slowly and methodically, right? He's in a very stable industry. We're in the business of risk in media. And if you're not willing to take big risks and take big shots and take big swings, then you're never going to get anywhere, because there is no stability in the media, no matter what you want to do, radio, TV, writing. There is no safe play. And if you do play safe, you're going to play small. And I realized that early on, and that's how I try to live my life.
Yeah, all of that is very outstanding. Congrats on the pregnancy from Nick and I. You know, wish you the best. I have one last question before we let you go. You mentioned your extensive Rolodex of people that you've had relationships with over the course of the last decade plus. You've had the opportunity to interview and develop bonds with some of the best people in the entire profession. So I wanted to ask, was there any particular interview or was there any particular interaction along the way that in particular stands out for you? Now, it could be because you had always wanted to interview this said person and you had the opportunity to do so, whether it was something that you needed help with and said person really came through for you in the clutch. So what interactions or what interviews throughout the course of your entire career stand out for you?
Gosh, I've had so many who have been really lucky. In 09, interviewing Derek Jeter, like a little voice in the back of your head is always like, this is Derek Jeter. You know, Mariano Rivera was on that team. Going from the 08 Rays to that team in 09 was unbelievable. In Baltimore, Cal Ripken Jr. was around a lot. And, you know, every time you can interview him or talk to him, I remember once I saw him at the airport and he's like, hey, Britt. And I about died inside. I'm like, oh my God, this guy knows my name. You know, it's like one thing that he kind of knows your face from interviewing, but I'm like, oh my God, he knows my name. Like, unbelievable. And there's been a lot of players who, especially early on in my career, I think went to bat for me because, you know, it can be tough to be young. It can be tough to be a female. It can be tough to kind of prove yourself and prove that you know the sport, and that you want to do the job and you want to do it well. And I was really fortunate to have some really great veterans, especially in 08 with the Rays, who, you know, treated me the right way, treated me with respect, and, you know, kind of put in line anybody who didn't. Another moment that really stands out to me is in 2008, as I said, I interned with the Rays. When they were on the road, I would do some rehab stuff sometimes because you're in Florida and guys would be making rehab starts. And Dontrell Willis was rehabbing with the Tigers down in Lakeland, Class A. So MLB is like, you should go write a story for us. So I was like, okay, you know, so you're nervous, you're an intern, whatever. He pitches, we're all waiting, me and two or three other reporters, to go into the clubhouse. And the clubhouse attendant was like, you can't go in there. I was like, why can't I go in there? He's like, there's no women allowed in the clubhouse. Now this is 2008. It wasn't like 1970. Wow. And he's very adamant about it. And the other two reporters, I didn't know that well, just walked right in the clubhouse, didn't put up a fight for me, didn't nothing. Just walked right in the clubhouse. And, you know, keep in mind, I'm 20 years old, 21 years old, and I'm upset. You know, there's nobody around to help. You know, I'm basically in tears. Like, I'm going to have to call my editor and tell them I didn't get Dontrell Willis. You know, do I tell him why, you know? So this goes on for like 10 minutes. I'm arguing with the clubhouse guy. He's not going to let me in. Nobody else is around to help, as I said. Dontrell Willis comes out of the clubhouse. I remember he still got ice on his arm all wrapped. And he says, the clubhouse attendant, he's like, what's up? And the guy's like, she can't come in. And Dontrell's like, that's not right. And the clubhouse attendant's like, yeah, it is. She can't come in. He's like, well, I say she can come in. And so I remember he led me into the clubhouse. The other two reporters had already left. And he stayed there and answered my questions for as long as I needed. And he's like, you have any other problems, you let me know. And, you know, to this day, you know, he's out of the game now, but I've seen him around a lot and he's heard this story, and I'm a Dontrell Willis fan because of that. Right. It was so above and beyond what he needed to do. And I always think about that moment as well, because it's just like, really, I was just so beside myself having to tell my editors as an intern, hey, I didn't get the story you sent me to go do. Right. Like, how? And it's like, do you explain? 'Cause you're female. Are they going to be like, this is why we can't have her do anything, you know? So I always think about that moment as well. And there's been so many people who have done smaller things, but Dontrell Willis that day, every time I go to Lakeland, I was just there last week. I always think about that moment in time. It was very, very important to me.
It's a great, great story. Now we're Dontrell Willis fans, and it's unbelievable that happened in 2008. That's really absurd. It's the first time I ever heard about that, but luckily it all worked out for you. It doesn't matter what you look like. Cream always rises to the top, and evidently you're very, very good at what you do, or else you wouldn't be around. So, Britt, thank you for joining us. Once again, we really, really appreciate this. And what we do here is we give our guests the last word. So if there's anything else you would like to share, if there's anything else you would like to promote, go right ahead. We wish you and your soon to be bigger family the best into the future. And we hope you enjoy the upcoming season.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, you can find me on The Athletic. You can follow me on Twitter, @_Giroli. Yes, it's Italian. Yes, it's very complicated. Just type in GH and hopefully, yeah, exactly. And hopefully it comes up. Don't have much to say, except I'm finally ready for baseball to start. And I'm sorry about this, but I do think the Mets are going to be good. I know this only pleases half this podcast. I think the Mets are going to be better than the Yankees. And I'm going to go on record here in March, the last day of March, and say that I think the Mets are going to go farther than the Yankees.
And Nick is going to chop that up and make that a really nice social clip. We'll be able to forget that.
We can only hope. We can only hope. All right, Brett, we appreciate it. Thank you so much. And let's play ball, ready for that baseball season as well. So that's going to do it for this episode of You Know I'm Right. For our special guest, Brett, my co-host, Joe, I am Nick. And this has been You Know I'm Right.